From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a ceasefire for Gaza collapses and the humanitarian situation worsens as hospitals report difficulties.
They're full, running low on supplies, their staff are exhausted.
Australia targets homegrown terrorists. The WHO drafts a $100 million plan to fight Ebola, and a Uganda court annuls the anti-gay law. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The Israeli military says one of its soldiers may have been captured by militants in the Gaza Strip, where a temporary ceasefire collapsed just hours after it began today. The abduction reportedly occurred in the southern city of Rafah, an hour and a half after the humanitarian truce between Israel and Hamas took effect. Then the Israeli military resumed shelling Gaza, and militants resumed firing rockets into southern Israel. VOA correspondent Scott Bobb is on the streets of Gaza. He says residents are aware of developments concerning their plight.
They do follow the news. They tend to follow the local news much more closely than anything else. Without electricity, it's hard to follow television newscasts and most radio newscasts. They do get, although very few people, once the batteries run out, it's hard to have a radio into working. So it's a bit of a struggle, but they are aware of what's going on, at least in their lives and in their territory, and of course they're still very concerned.
He says hospitals are reporting difficulties.
The hospitals are dealing with a major humanitarian crisis in that they're full, running low on supplies, their staff are exhausted, and for instance, many of them have been using generator power because there's no public electricity. I understand that they're trying to set up a line from Israel into the main hospital, the Shifa hospital, but it's still very, very difficult, and there have been several urgent calls for assistance on the health front.
I asked Scott about evacuating the injured from the hospitals.
Well, Israel has set up a field hospital near Erez, its crossing, and it says it is willing to treat Palestinians, but many Palestinians are reluctant to go there. It just has to do with the suspicion and with the strong feelings against Israel because of this violence.
During the lull in fighting, Scott says some fishermen were able to return to their work. But would Gaza residents be able to escape by the sea?
Oh, that's impossible. There are half a dozen warships visible on the horizon, the near horizon, and at night they're brightly lit up like Christmas trees. That's impossible, and that's why the fishermen only go out a few hundred meters. They're not going out beyond the port extent, the furthest of the port, because it's extremely dangerous, and they're very afraid. That is not going to happen until there's some sort of agreement whereby Israel allows them to go out a certain distance. They're very strict about watching for that.
And with all the death and suffering, is there any sign that Hamas will be willing to give up?
I would say there's no sign of that officially as yet. Hamas continues to insist on a complete end to the blockade before it will consider a formal official ceasefire, and Israel insists on the demilitarization of Gaza before it will consider lifting any blockade.
VOA correspondent Scott Bobb speaking with us from Gaza. Australian police have issued arrest warrants for two Australian Islamic State fighters after one of them was pictured online brandishing the severed heads of Syrian government soldiers. Authorities are drafting new laws to combat the rising threat of homegrown extremism in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The two suspects have been identified by Australian police as Khaled Sharouf and Mohamed Elamar. They're thought to be with the radical Islamic State fighters in Syria. Photographs posted on social media show Elamar holding severed heads in his hands, and he boasts that he would cut the throats of infidels. The two men from Sydney are considered to be the two most notorious Australians fighting with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. Neil Gagan, Australia's Deputy Federal Police Commissioner, says the two are now wanted on terrorism-related charges.
Words don't adequately describe how abhorrent those photographs are. I mean, 30 years of policing, it's probably one of the worst things, if not the worst thing I've seen. The Australian government, rightly so, came out very strongly on Friday, criticising very strongest possible terms the type of behaviour that those two gentlemen are allegedly involved in. I can assure the Australian community that we have current first instance warrants for their arrest, and as soon as they set foot in Australian soil, they'll be taken into custody.
It's understood that Elamar and Sharouf had links to a teenager from the Australian city of Melbourne. Authorities say that 18-year-old Adam Darman blew himself up in Baghdad in a suicide bombing killing five last week. He was questioned by Australia's intelligence agencies before he flew to the Middle East last year. But authorities say they had insufficient powers to stop him from leaving the country. In Canberra, the government is preparing new laws that would make it easier to prosecute terrorism cases. Australia's Attorney General George Brandis says there's a small yet dangerous group of homegrown extremists.
The one thing that no Australian should ever think is that this is a problem that exists on the other side of the world. Because while it might take shape on the other side of the world, the number of Australians who are participating in this war fighting in Syria and Iraq shows that this is a problem that exists and germinates within our suburbs, within the suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane, among a very small number of people, a very, very small number of people. But nevertheless, this is a product which has a domestic germination.
The Australian Security Intelligence Organisation wants greater powers to monitor the phones and emails of terrorism suspects. Its Director General is David Irvine.
We've always been worried about the threat of homegrown terrorism. In the last 10 years, we have actually stopped four mass casualty attacks occurring in Australia when we stopped them quite early in their planning stages.
The government estimates that there are 150 Australians fighting with radical groups overseas. Richard Barrett is a former British diplomat and senior vice president of the strategic intelligence provider, the Sufan Group, which advises governments on security and intelligence matters. He says the concern is that Western fighters in Iraq and Syria will carry out atrocities when they get back home.
There's been a man, a Frenchman, who went back to Europe and killed four people outside the Jewish Museum in Brussels not very long ago. He'd been with the Islamic State, or the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria as it was then, for about a year beforehand. So clearly, even if it's not radicalizing people to that point, their participation in that fight, clearly it's attracting people who could very well commit terrorist acts back in their home countries. And I think that's, you know, it's a very legitimate concern.
Muslim groups in Australia say that organizations such as the Islamic State are winning over young people thanks to slick online propaganda campaigns. The Muslim groups are calling for community leaders to be vigilant in the face of the threat of homegrown extremism. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
Several dozen international investigators have begun working at the crash site of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 in eastern Ukraine. Investigators from the Netherlands and Australia, along with accompanying officials from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, today began combing an area now designated as a crime scene. They will focus on recovering several dozen bodies still missing and retrieving the belongings of the 298 people killed when the Boeing 777 was shot down last month. The team of investigators on Thursday managed to reach the crash site for the first time since it was brought down by a missile. Ertugrul Upkhan is the chief monitor of the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission to Ukraine.
All parties were responsive in the manner that the international team reached over there. And we count on the arrangements that our team was able to go there each day, every day, in order to carry out this investigation in the upcoming 2 or 3 weeks' time.
Clashes along routes to the wreckage site between government troops and pro-Russian separatist rebels had kept the delegation from reaching the area to retrieve bodies. Ukraine's deputy prime minister vowed to maintain a safe route leading to the crash site so it can continue to be used to access the embattled region. Volodymyr Grossman also said an agreement ratified in Parliament would allow some 700 people, including international investigators and military personnel, to operate on the crash site. The Director General of the World Health Organization and leaders of three West African countries infected with Ebola are jointly launching a $100 million emergency plan to combat the deadly disease. It is part of an intensified international, regional, and national campaign to bring the devastating outbreak under control. The latest figures from the WHO show 1,323 confirmed and suspected cases, including 729 deaths in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone since March. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization calls the scale of the ongoing Ebola outbreak unprecedented. But WHO spokesman Gregory Hartl tells VOA the outbreak is probably worse than the figures indicate.
There could well be cases in the community that we've missed, because this has been one of the biggest challenges, you know, in terms of also tracing contacts. People run away. They don't want to be treated in health centers. They're afraid, or they don't believe that the health centers can do them any good, so they go try to be treated by their families, and they get sick and die there.
Hartl says key elements of the emergency plan are to stop transmission of the Ebola virus and to prevent the spread of the disease to neighboring at-risk countries by strengthening and scaling up all control and response measures. He calls this a huge undertaking and says 600 more people are needed in the field to carry it out.
The biggest challenge of this outbreak has been the fact that there are so many different centers of transmission. And at every center of transmission, you need a full team of clinical specialists, of infection control specialists, of logisticians, of lab people, of community communicators, of epidemiologists who go out and trace contacts.
Spokesman for the International Red Cross Federation, Benoit Carpentier, says identifying people infected with Ebola and tracing those who have come in contact with them is a mammoth task.
If one person that is contaminated gets in contact with 20 other people, then you've got 20 people that you need to follow up for 21 days. And if these 20 people get in contact with 20 other. I mean, you see how it gets exponential very, very quickly.
Ebola has an incubation period of between 2 and 21 days. It is spread through contact with the blood or bodily fluids of an infected person. There is no cure, and fatality rates can be as high as 90%. But health officials stress people who seek treatment at a clinic as soon as they fall ill have a better chance of survival. Initial flu-like symptoms can lead to external hemorrhaging from areas like eyes and gums, and internal bleeding, which can lead to organ failure. Some 2,400 volunteers from the International Red Cross Federation have been working in the three infected countries since the Ebola epidemic started. Carpentier says it is this message of hope that Red Cross volunteers are trying to communicate.
We have a good example of a person in Guinea that was infected and survived, and he's now a Red Cross volunteer, and he goes, you know, community to community to actually pass that message of hope.
West African leaders were initially slow to react to the outbreak. They now are taking extraordinary measures to contain the disease. Liberia has closed its schools, ordered non-essential public servants to stay home from work, and closed its borders. Sierra Leone has declared a state of emergency and called in troops to quarantine Ebola victims. Gregory Hartl of the World Health Organization says it is too soon to know whether these measures will be successful.
But certainly it's very good that these countries are thinking along the lines of the fact that something extraordinary needs to be done. Well, I think what we need to do is look at any and all measures which are taken in the light of, will they help bring the outbreak under control?
A U.S. citizen has died from Ebola in Nigeria after being infected in Liberia. U.S. health authorities are warning against travel to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. But the World Health Organization does not endorse a travel ban. It also advises against border closures, saying they might be helpful, but are not foolproof. The UN Health Agency says the best way to tackle Ebola and to stop the outbreak is to put the necessary measures in place at the source of the infection. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Additional U.S. experts are being sent to the area to help the governments of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea manage the crisis. Faith Lapidus provides us with this report.
Thomas Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, addressed what he called the biggest and most complex Ebola outbreak in history, centered along the common border of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea.
Over the next 30 days, we plan to send an additional 50 CDC disease control specialists into the three countries. These individuals will help countries establish emergency operations centers that can develop a structured and effective way of addressing the outbreak. This is being done in close collaboration with the World Health Organization. They will also help strengthen laboratory networks so testing for the disease can be done rapidly. And third, building the capacity of individuals from within the area to do these functions for this outbreak and future threats as well.
He identified two major challenges those governments face in trying to control the situation.
Many of the health systems in these countries are not highly functional. They may not reach into rural areas, healthcare workers may not reliably be present at facilities, and facilities may have very limited capacities. Second, in some areas, there has been lack of understanding and hostility or violence against some of the groups that are trying to respond to the outbreaks.
Among the CDC experts headed to the region will be airport screeners to help countries identify travelers who may be sick. Frieden also announced a more urgent travel alert, advising Americans to avoid any non-essential trips to the area. He reviewed three key steps to stop the outbreak: rapidly identifying and isolating patients, finding and following anyone they had contact with over the previous 3 weeks to see if they developed symptoms, providing supportive care and treatment centers, and preventing future cases through education, strict adherence to quarantine protocols, and avoiding the consumption of bushmeat and bats. He compared the effort to fighting forest fires.
If you leave behind even one burning ember, one case undetected, it could reignite the epidemic. So difficult as it is, it can be done. And I'm confident that as we make progress over the coming weeks and months, we will not only begin to tamp down these outbreaks, but leave behind stronger systems that will be able to find, stop before they spread, and prevent more effectively Ebola and other health threats.
Frieden concluded, this is a marathon, not a sprint, warning it will take 3 to 6 months to get the situation under control. Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
Uganda's constitutional court has overturned a controversial anti-homosexuality law that made same-sex acts punishable by up to life in prison. VOA's Gabe Joselo reports, while the law was annulled because of procedural errors in its passing, rights groups still hailed the decision as a boost for gay rights in the country.
The court Friday ruled the Anti-Homosexuality Act unconstitutional because it was passed in Parliament without enough members present for a full quorum. The act, which increased punishments for same-sex acts and the promotion of homosexuality, was passed in December and signed into law in February. Human Rights Watch LGBT senior researcher Neela Gaushal tells VOA Friday's ruling is a victory for gay rights, even though the court did not address the ethical aspects of the law.
The court hasn't had an opportunity to rule on the real sort of substance matter of the case. But, you know, the fact is that everybody is breathing a sigh of relief in Uganda right now because the law can no longer be enforced from today.
Leading Ugandan gay rights activist Frank Mugisha summed up his feelings about the ruling in a single tweet, saying, "Breaking news, I am officially legal." Gaushal points out existing laws on the books in Uganda banning homosexuality will remain in place while the state decides whether to reintroduce the act in Parliament or to appeal Friday's decision at the Supreme Court. Still, she says the annulment of the law gives gay rights activists in Uganda legal leverage to fight a reported surge in discrimination, including evictions, jobs lost, and denial of medical treatment since it was passed.
So there is space for people who are victims of social pressure, victims of violence, feel that they can take their complaints somewhere and hopefully obtain some access to justice.
At the time of signing, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni said homosexuals should be punished harshly in order to defend society from disorientation. Uganda faced a massive backlash from rights groups and the international community. Several countries, including the United States, reduced or redirected aid to Uganda. In a statement released July 7th, the Ugandan government said the law has been misinterpreted by development partners as intending to discriminate against homosexuals, saying instead the law meant to curb the promotion of homosexuality, especially among children. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Today is the fourth anniversary of the treaty banning cluster bombs. Supporters say stockpiles of the weapons are being destroyed in record numbers. However, they say the weapons have been used in Syria for the past 2 years. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Cluster munitions are designed to open in midair and release small explosives or bomblets, sometimes hundreds of them. Not all of them explode when they hit the ground, and therein lies the hidden danger. They act like landmines, easily set off by touch. Many of the victims are civilians. The Convention on Cluster Munitions bans all use, production, transfer, and stockpiling of the weapons. It's the same language used in the treaty banning landmines. The convention has led to the clearing of hundreds of square kilometers contaminated by bomblets. It also contains provisions for the care and rehabilitation of survivors and their communities. Amy Little, campaign manager for the Cluster Munitions Coalition, says the treaty is working.
Already 71% of the stockpiled cluster munitions by state parties have been destroyed. And last year alone, that's 27 million submunitions destroyed as a result of this treaty.
She says most of the countries with victims of cluster munitions have joined the treaty.
The other impact of the treaty has been to stigmatize the use of the weapon and production. And in effect, we've seen a massive reduction in the use of the weapon as a result of the treaty. The work is not done yet. And the ongoing use in Syria is of real concern and must stop.
Little says cluster munitions have been used in 10 out of 14 governorates in Syria.
Up until April, we had recorded over 224 locations, and we now know this number is going to grow. We'll know the more realistic figures when the Cluster Munition Monitor 2014 is released in September.
Cluster munitions are reported to have contaminated Syrian schools, playgrounds, housing, and roads.
Places where you know and can predict that civilians are to be found. The problem with cluster munitions is that they can't be targeted. They're an indiscriminate weapon. Each cluster bomb strike can fall to an area the size of several football fields. Anyone underneath that strike is at severe risk of death or injury.
Little says the weapons are unreliable, with a failure rate of up to 30%. That leaves the unexploded bomblets scattered over wide areas. The Cluster Munitions Coalition is investigating reports from earlier this year that the weapon was used in South Sudan. It appears to be an isolated incident. The coalition is also following up on reports the weapon may have been used in Ukraine. Cluster munitions had been reported used in the Libyan conflict several years ago. A total of 113 countries have signed or acceded to the convention. The coalition says 29 signatories are in the process of ratifying it.
The USA, unfortunately, still remains outside of the treaty. It's no longer using the weapon, but we still expect it to fall within the provisions of the treaty by destroying its stockpiles and ceasing production.
The U.S. has not joined the landmine treaty either. However, the Obama administration has taken steps to reduce the U.S. stockpile. In June, a conference was held in Maputo, Mozambique, to assess the progress of the mine treaty. Ambassador Douglas Griffiths said the U.S. stopped producing or acquiring landmines. The U.S. has also played a major role in assisting in mine clearance. As for the cluster munitions treaty, Russia and China have not joined the convention yet either. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com for all the latest. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.